It was a cold Wednesday morning in early November 1998. A little over a year since I'd started working in the Garda fingerprint department. I was 26 years old. Still a trainee scenes of crime examiner, a greenhorn. I couldn't go out to serious crime scenes on my own just yet. The training wheels were still on. I could, however, tag along with a fully qualified expert to assist them and, more importantly, to learn. I had just arrived into the fingerprints office in the technical bureau when the call came in. The superintendent in charge of the Kilo Bravo district, which is the Finglas area of North Dublin City, was requesting a bureau team. A body had been discovered. A woman in her early 70s. Lying on the cold cement floor of the cramp garage adjoining her house on Benevan Road in the Ballygall area of Finglas. There was no ambiguity. This hadn't been an accident. It wasn't the result of a fall or some kind of medical emergency. 72-year-old Marie Dillon had suffered an extremely violent death. I was about to experience my first murder scene. I was going to step beyond the crime scene tape, and my eyes were about to be opened. All murder scenes are grim, but this one was different. No apparent motive. No suspects. A complete whodunit. When someone is murdered in Ireland, the Gardaí call in a team of forensic scenes of crime examiners from the Technical Bureau. For 25 years, I was a part of that team. My name is John Sweetman. I was there to help read the silent and often hidden clues at a crime scene. I saw what killers tried to hide. Fingerprints unknowingly left behind. Murder weapons hidden in plain sight. Handwriting that betrayed a lie. Every detail told the real story. And now, I'll tell you those stories. In this new podcast from Go Loud, I take you inside some of Ireland's most haunting crimes. This is Lines of Inquiry, a Go Loud original podcast that looks beyond the headlines, following the evidence step by step and uncovering the stories behind the investigations. In this episode, the brutal and senseless murder of Marie Dillon, an elderly widow living alone in the heart of Dublin City's northern suburbs. A crime seemingly without motive, and equally lacking in any viable suspects. Marie Dillon was 72 years old when she was murdered. A native of West Cork, she had moved to Dublin, marrying and setting up home on Benevan Road in Finglas, in the northern suburbs of Dublin City. Her husband died young, and by the time of her death, Marie had been a widow for almost 30 years. She had no children. Marie had been an active member of the NAWI, the National Association of Widows in Ireland, and for two decades she had worked to help women in need in North Dublin. She had been particularly concerned about violence against women living alone and had herself suffered a number of burglaries and acts of vandalism at her home. Marie's home had been broken into the previous year, and someone had vandalised her car. In that same garage, her little yellow Mini. She must have been shaken by that, because she never drove that car again. But that wasn't to say she lived in fear of an attack. Many people who knew her remembered her as a brave, fearless woman. Quiet in many ways, gentle, kind, but afraid of nothing. On the night of the 23rd of November 1998, Marie had been socialising with friends and was last seen alive at 10:30 p.m., when she left to get the bus home. 2 days later, on the morning of the 25th, another friend grew increasingly concerned about her after knocking repeatedly at her door and getting no reply. He alerted the local Gardaí, and when they arrived at Benevan Road, they made the grim discovery. Gardaí found Marie Dillon's body in the garage adjoining the house, wedged in the narrow space between the wall and the driver's side of her little car. She was partially naked and appeared to have been savagely beaten to death. Gardaí cordoned off the crime scene. It comprised the garage, the driveway, the small front and rear gardens, as well as the house itself. As the crime scene tape was being unfurled, The services of the Technical Bureau and the Office of the State Pathologist were called for. The news of what had been done to Marie was spreading. The community was in shock. At this stage, details were sparse, but people knew it had been something horrific. And it wasn't just what had happened. It was somehow made even worse by who it had happened to. Marie was a much-loved woman. Her friends and neighbours remembered her as a gentle, caring person. They remembered someone who spent her days checking in on her frail and elderly neighbours. She would do their shopping for them and tidy up their gardens. She looked after people. One friend told the reporter Marie was just goodness itself, a lovely, lovely person. And she was funny. She would always have a smile and a joke. I arrived at Benevon Road with the rest of the Technical Bureau team, not long after the discovery of Marie's body, but I didn't enter right away. First, the Bureau photographer had to make a visual document of the scene, with pictures and video, capturing everything in situ, including, and most importantly, the deceased. I waited, with a mixture of nerves and excitement. What was I about to be exposed to? So, with no small amount of butterflies in my stomach, I entered the garage. It was cramped, dark, barely enough room for the little group of us. We were all suited up in white crime scene suits, complete with shoe covers. We all wore gloves, yet nobody touched or moved anything. The time for detailed examination would come, but for now, Marie Dillon's body was the most important component of the scene. The photographer erected a light on a tall tripod, and I got my first real look at the poor woman's remains. This wasn't my first dead body. As part of my training, I'd been to the morgue on several occasions to take prints from deceased persons, and had, just a few months earlier, attended the scene of a suicide. But this was different. Even to my trainee's eyes, it was apparent that Marie Dillon had been the victim of a particularly brutal attack. She was lying face down, with what appeared to be severe head injuries, leaving her hair thickly matted with blood. Her lower clothing had been pulled down below her knees, and further blood spatter stood out on her pale skin. There is always the initial shock to the senses when entering a crime scene involving violent death, but you have to adjust quickly, and the work takes over. While we worked meticulously inside the small spaces alongside the car and around Marie's body, on the streets, detectives and uniformed guardie were facing into a mystery with no obvious path to a solution. They knocked on doors, they went to local businesses, a garage, a late-night video rental place, and asked for their CCTV footage. They would have worked to establish who saw Marie last, what were her last known movements. The senior investigating guardie would have gathered together to work out a plan of action and directed others to knock on doors and see if anybody had seen or heard anything unusual. They would have gone back to the records to see if anything similar had happened in the area in recent times, an assault, a burglary, even a murder. Not yet knowing the motive or nature of the attack fully, they had to consider if it had been a sexual assault. And in those early hours, Gardaí and Finglas began compiling a list of sexual offenders from the north of Dublin City. They worked up a shortlist of potential suspects. As is the nature of this work, often you follow the best possible path, even if you have no idea if it'll be a road to nowhere. Above all, they worked fast, knowing a killer was on the loose. It was around then that, in my opinion, the single most important person in the initial stages of an investigation into a suspicious death arrived. The state pathologist, Dr. Mary Cassidy. Dr. Cassidy carried out a preliminary examination of the deceased, including taking an internal temperature reading, which would assist in establishing an estimate of the time of death. When Dr. Cassidy's work was done, I assisted in the removal of Marie Dillon's body from the scene, so it could be brought to Dublin City Morgue for the post-mortem examination. We wrapped the poor woman's body in plastic sheeting to retain any trace evidence that might be on her body. She was then placed in a metal casket and removed to the morgue by a local undertaker. The area where she had been lying in the garage would be photographed and combed for any useful evidence, as would the entire garage, gardens, and even the house itself if it was deemed necessary. As crime scene manager, my sergeant then arranged for a tow truck to bring Marie Dillon's car, undercover, to a secure location where it could be forensically examined later. Next, we had a post-mortem to attend. The scene would remain cordoned off and secure until we could return. The old Dublin City Morgue had been built in 1901 and was located behind the Coroner's Court on Store Street in the heart of Dublin city centre. Entering it was like stepping back into the Edwardian era, with its white tiled floors and walls. Its wire-strengthened glass ceiling let the natural light shine down on the three white marble autopsy tables anchored to the floor. Postmortems, or autopsies and suspicious death investigations, are typically long affairs, lasting several hours. When we arrived at the morgue, Marie Dillon's body was already lying on one of the examination tables, still wrapped in plastic. With the Garda photographer capturing everything, Dr. Cassidy, aided by the senior mortician and the ballistics expert, unwrapped the body and removed the clothes and any other items such as jewellery, all of which were catalogued and bagged for further examination back at the Forensic Science Laboratory in Garda headquarters. Then Dr. Cassidy carried out a full external examination before moving on to the internal one. Usually, the fingerprinting of a body is done once the post-mortem has concluded, so the fingerprint expert and I had plenty of time to look on in morbid fascination as the pathologist went about her dissections. All the while, the photographer's camera was clicking away. During a post-mortem, the pathologist must examine everything, internally and externally, and it is not pleasant. There is no pretty way to do it, but it has to be done. As Dr. Cassidy worked, she meticulously noted all injuries. Again, the ballistics expert took possession of any samples from the body. Dr. Cassidy also allowed the fingerprint expert to apply black fingerprint powder to the exposed skull so as to provide better contrast for the photographer's pictures of the damage done to the bone. I was sent back to headquarters to fetch some amido black, which is a chemical that can enhance crime scene marks made in blood by staining it a dark blue or black colour. It was applied to parts of Marie Dillon's body in the hope of enhancing footmarks, where it appeared her attacker had stamped on her, but we had little success with it. Still, we had to try it. After several hours, I assisted my colleague in taking a set of fingerprints, helping to apply black ink to Marie's hands and transferring rolled impressions of them onto paper. By this time, the little waiting area of the morgue was becoming quite crowded. Investigating Gardaí from Finglas, as well as members from NBCI, the National Bureau of Criminal Investigation, were eagerly awaiting the pathologist's findings. Not a person to be rushed, and rightly so, Dr. Cassidy presented them with the facts once her examinations were complete. She had noted that Marie Dillon's body showed extensive injuries, including fractures of the facial bones and skull. She also had a dislocated shoulder. She had been severely beaten. The cause of death was blunt force trauma to the head, chest, and abdomen. Mercifully, there was no evidence of sexual assault. As the crowd in that waiting room listened intently to Dr. Cassidy, Gardaí and Finglas were out hunting for clues, looking for witnesses, taking statements, trying to find anything that might help, any small piece of information, even a tiny fraction of an answer. There was so much unknown that first night, and right then no clear sight of how we might untangle the mystery. But as Dr. Cassidy spoke, it became clear that we had one certainty. Someone had murdered Marie Dillon. The wheels of the investigation were already in motion, and myself and the rest of the bureau team still had a crime scene to process. Gardaí were anxious. The killer was still out there, and their identity was still completely unknown. The evidence procured by the state pathologist during the post-mortem on Marie Dillon led to a full-blown murder investigation. Finglas Gardaí, aided by members from NBCI, would be canvassing the local area, following up on any leads or information, no matter how small or seemingly inconsequential. The autopsy had gone on until late into the night, so it wasn't until the next morning that the Technical Bureau team returned to the scene at Benevon Road. With Marie's car now back at Garda headquarters awaiting examination, there was more room to manoeuvre in the little garage. As we slowly worked around it, we got the full picture of the horror that had unfolded here. Evidence of a brutal beating was plain to see. A pool of blood lay on the floor where Marie's body had been found, and there were further splashes leading up the wall, indicating that she had been hit repeatedly while lying there. Later, during the examination of the car, more blood was observed, including on its underside. This made us suspect that this was a sustained attack, with Marie's killer continuing his assault after she had fallen to the ground. Blood spatter analysis was one of the many disciplines that the ballistics expert was qualified in, so he busied himself by taking notes and making sketches, determining the direction of the blood scattering. The photographer captured it all. Every moment and measurement was precise, patient, but the pressure was only growing. I assisted the fingerprint expert in examining any surfaces likely to retain what we call latent or hidden finger marks, including the broken window at the rear of the garage and the doors opening out onto the driveway. The outer side of these doors yielded fresh finger marks when powdered. Maybe something, maybe not. We would see. The garage was filled with firewood, coal, old gardening equipment, bits and bobs that had been accrued over many years. Dust and cobwebs hung in the air. We conducted a fingertip search, looking for anything of evidential value, perhaps something left behind by the murderer. Maybe even the weapon the killer used to beat Marie Dillon to death. An old garden rake lay on the floor, close to where the body had been found. It had little weight to it, with a thin wooden handle. There was only a small amount of blood on it. I remember thinking that this rake seemed too flimsy to have inflicted those injuries. But of course, it was photographed and bagged for further examination. When you can make sense of nothing, you have to consider everything. I noted several broken slabs of concrete lying around. These weren't bloodstained, but perhaps the killer had used something like them, or some other object as a weapon, and taken it with him when he had fled the scene. Again, you take it all in. Anything is possible. Having thoroughly combed the garage for evidence, we turned our attention to the house itself. A reasonably spacious, two-storied, semi-detached affair, a picture of what should have been a quiet, peaceful suburban life. While we looked around the house, we noticed some signs that someone had attempted to scale a drainpipe at the rear of the property. We took a closer look, but no identifiable finger marks were found. We also didn't find any external evidence of an attempt having been made to break in. We went through the house room by room, no signs of disturbance. Nothing broken. No household items scattered around. This was not the scene you'd find in typical burglaries. The more we looked, the less it made sense. Marie Dillon's home was neat and clean, but almost every room contained plastic bags filled with all sorts of her belongings. Books, old photos, unused household appliances. It gave the impression that she had been loath to throw these things out. Not a hoarder by any means, but someone who liked to hang on to things, just in case they might be needed. Everything in its place and close to hand if required. It made me sad to think that none of it mattered now. It was now time to turn our attention to Marie Dillon's car. It had been removed from the scene undercover the previous day. Like any piece of evidence, it was moved carefully, carried on a truck, as any attempt to drive it would likely result in any evidence in it or on it being tainted or destroyed. The car had been brought to Garda headquarters in Phoenix Park. It was a nearly new black Fiat Cinquecento, and it appeared that Marie Dillon had rarely driven it. It was covered in a thin layer of dust. This was advantageous for us because, under the ceiling lights and the mounted lights provided by the photographer, we were able to discern obvious finger marks where the dust had been disturbed. These marks were on the bonnet and both sides of the car. The finger marks on the passenger side were low down, as if whoever had left them had been crouching down. Perhaps it had been the murderer lying in wait. Other marks were found higher up towards the rear of the driver's side, which would have been close to where Marie's body had been found. Most promising of all were the finger marks on the front bonnet. One appeared to have been made in blood. Very carefully, small swabs were taken without destroying any detail in the mark. These swabs would be sent to the forensic laboratory to confirm if the substance was in fact blood. The bureau photographer then spent at least 45 minutes capturing as clear a picture as possible of this particular mark. He set up a weighty, older type of camera on a boom which was suspended above the bonnet. He had to hang his kit bag on the opposite end for balance. The slightest movement of the camera would result in blurred images, so he locked up the shutter, taking longer exposures of the finger mark. We lifted and catalogued each of the finger marks and moved on to examine the rest of the car, dusting it with fingerprint powder. But no more marks were found. It was now time to find out if the evidence gleaned from Marie Dillon's car could bring us any closer to unmasking her killer. The Garda photographer wasted no time in developing the photographed finger marks. Armed with these and the taped lifts themselves, I accompanied the fingerprint expert to the AFIS suite in the fingerprint section. AFIS, the Automated Fingerprint Identification System, had been up and running for only 2 years. It was state-of-the-art, containing digital scans of the many thousands of sets of prints in the National Collection. Prior to the introduction of AFIS, all these sets had to be sorted and classified using the old Henry system of numerical classification. This system was named after Sir Edward Henry, who had helped formulate and perfect the system between 1896 and 1925. With AFIS, we had gone from the slow, laborious process of a 19th century system to a state-of-the-art tool. The various fingerprint patterns, whorls, loops and arches, were assigned specific numerical values depending on which fingers they appeared. So a right thumb is number 1, your left thumb is number 6, and so on. There was a further level of subclassification based on friction ridge detail in each print. Friction ridges are what the various patterns on a fingerprint are made up of. This coarse ridge skin is found on the surfaces of the fingers, the thumbs and palms, and also on the soles of the feet. It forms before birth and persists unchanged throughout life until after death and decomposition. Only deep cuts or burns can permanently alter the arrangement of these ridges. Forkings in these ridges, or abrupt stops and starts, are known as ridge characteristics. And it is in comparing these characteristics that fingerprint identifications can be made. The ridge characteristics and their arrangements are unique to every individual, even in identical twins. Therefore, if two finger marks or prints agree in their arrangement of ridge characteristics, then it can be stated with certainty that they came from the same person. It follows then that if a finger mark found at a crime scene can be matched to a named set of fingerprints, you can be sure that that person was responsible for making that mark. Under the old Henry system, crime scene marks had to be manually classified and then searched through the collection by hand. The introduction of AFIS did away with that time-consuming and laborious old system. Now, searches could be made through the entire fingerprint collection in minutes, providing the details were entered correctly by the operator. The fingerprint expert took a seat at one of the vacant AFIS workstations, flanked by myself, my sergeant and the photographer, all eager to see if the system would throw back any promising results. We picked the finger mark with the clearest level of detail to be scanned in first, using the desk-mounted camera. This also happened to be the mark made in what appeared to be blood on the bonnet of Marie Dillon's car. From its shape and ridge arrangement, we thought that it was most likely made by a left thumb. This meant narrowing the search, nominating digit number 6, that's the left thumb. So the AFIS computer would only scan for left thumbs in the national database. Narrowing the search further, a pattern was selected, a left loop. Then the expert carefully plotted in as many clear ridge characteristics as could be seen in the enlargement of the mark on the monitor. It's precise work and takes a keen eye, but if you're going to find your match on a fingerprint, it has to be exact. Now it was crunch time. A mouse click on the search button sent the search off, whizzing through every stored left thumb with a left loop pattern. Thousands upon thousands of them. Was one of them possibly belonging to a killer? That was, of course, assuming their fingerprints were on file. You're searching through a haystack, not even knowing if the needle exists. By narrowing the search parameters, it only took a few minutes before AFIS came back with the results. It's important to remember that AFIS doesn't make identifications. It simply performs a search based on the information you give it. It then brings back a list of fingerprints in the database that match closest, typically 30, ranking them on how closely they match the mark you have fed into it. The expert then has to visually compare each one on screen against the crime scene mark. The respondents that AFIS brings back don't show any names, just a lengthy code, telling you where you can find each physical set of fingerprints in the large fireproof storage units, often another part of the department. The list popped up on the screen. My heart was racing. The top respondent showed a tantalizingly high score. Was this it? My colleague clicked on it, and up came an image of the left thumb from that set of fingerprints, side by side with the mark from the car bonnet. You could hear a pin drop. The expert scrutinized each image, marking in matching characteristics one by one, as were my sergeant and myself doing mentally. It felt like the air around us was crackling with excitement. Nobody said anything. Not yet. A fingerprint identification, or ident, is not made with electronic images on a computer screen, but from one-to-one comparison between a physical set of inked fingerprints and a crime scene mark, be it a lift or a photograph. The computer can only get you so far, then it comes back to the fingerprint expert. The set of prints was retrieved from the storage unit, and the expert sat down to carry out his comparison using his magnifying glass. After what seemed to me to be the longest few minutes, he sat back, a barely concealed smile on his face. It's him. The sergeant immediately went about verifying the identification by doing his own comparison. Satisfied, he then allowed me to compare them. All the details were in agreement. No unexplainable discrepancies or anomalies. They matched. The identification was good. Hands were shook. Backs were slapped. There was still work to be done. We had other exhibits from the scene to examine, and my sergeant would have to immediately inform the investigating Gardaí at Finglas of our findings. They, in turn, would have to put eyes on this new person of interest. I looked again at the set of fingerprints and read the name at the top of the form. That name was Richard Kearney. Just a few months prior to Marie Dillon's murder in November of 1998, a man had his leather jacket stolen whilst out in a pub in the Finglas area. A short time later, he saw a local youth wearing it. The theft was reported to Gardaí, and the young man was arrested and charged. But before he was released from custody, pending a court date for the incident, the arresting Garda had the presence of mind to take a set of fingerprints from him. Not routine in all cases, just good police work. That young jacket thief was Richard Kearney, and that was the first time he had ever been fingerprinted. It was to prove invaluable months later as we searched for the killer of Marie Dillon. From the fingerprints taken that day in the Garda station, we were able to make sense of the critical piece of evidence in the case, the bloody thumbprint on the bonnet of Marie Dillon's car. Marie Dillon had been murdered sometime between late on the night of the 23rd of November 1998 and 2 days later when her body had been discovered. And so, by the evening of the 26th, we had our suspect. Richard Kearney lived only a short distance from the scene at Benevon Road, in Finglas Place, and he was only 17 years old. When you hear that, you wonder, could someone so young have been responsible for such a ferocious and sustained attack on a 72-year-old woman? The Forensic Science Laboratory had confirmed that the identified left thumb mark from the bonnet of Marie Dillon's car had indeed been made in blood, and more damning yet, that blood belonged to the deceased. It is a sad fact in the majority of murder investigations that the killer is known to the victim, possibly even related to them. Had Marie known Kearney? Why had he been in her garage? What were his motives for the attack? These were all questions that the investigating Gardaí would put to the suspect once they had him in custody. While the Technical Bureau team finished the examination of the scene at Benevon Road and began sifting through exhibits and samples, developing photographs, compiling reports, Richard Kearney's house was put under surveillance. The plan was to move in and arrest him early the next morning. In the small hours of Friday the 27th, watchful Gardaí suddenly noticed a commotion in the house in Finglas Place. Lights were being turned on, figures hurriedly moving about inside. Had the waiting Gardaí been rumbled? They decided to move in, and it transpired that the Kearneys had just received word a close family relative had suddenly died. Further woe was about to be visited on them, as the detective inspector from Finglas arrested Richard Kearney under the suspicion of having murdered Marie Dillon. Kearney was taken to Finglas Garda Station, while clothes and footwear were seized for forensic examination. Samples would be taken from him. Gardaí would take a fresh set of fingerprints and conduct lengthy formal interviews before he was officially charged with the crime and brought before a sitting of Dublin District Court. The evidence gathered from his home would prove critical. Some of Marie Dillon's blood was found on his runners. In turn, Carney's blood was found on Marie's bra. And do you remember that rake I mentioned earlier? The one I looked at in the garage and thought to myself, surely that's too flimsy to be a weapon? We found Carney's blood on that. That indicated he had injured himself during the ferocious attack. Perhaps most damning of all was the fingerprint evidence, which only grew. We already knew his thumbprint was in the victim's blood on the bonnet of the car. And as we worked through the rest of the finger marks, we found that every one of them matched Richard Carney too. He would be detained in custody whilst the lengthy and crucial process of compiling a book of evidence was carried out. With this complete, a trial date could be set. Marie Dillon's funeral was held exactly 1 week after her body had been found. The service in St. Canice's Church in Finglas was attended by roughly 700 people, predominantly middle-aged women, many of whom had known her from her work with the National Association of Widows in Ireland. Some of them formed a guard of honour at the door of the church, and her hearse carried 24 wreaths from association members. Her remaining family travelled from Cork, joining the large number of friends and neighbours from Benevon Road and surrounding areas. Many Garda members involved in the murder investigation also attended, as did Mrs. Rosemary Pierce, the national chairwoman of the International Federation of Widowed Persons, who had travelled from London. There were no politicians or public figures in attendance. A spokeswoman for the NAWI commented on this absence. She said, "Marie was a humble person, but she served the community much better than many people whose funerals would attract 30 or 40 representatives from all over the country." In his sermon, Father Paul Thornton said, "In searching for hope, we have to look at Marie's life and remember how she was so dedicated to people in their weakest moments." Marie Dillon was laid to rest in Glasnevin Cemetery beside her husband, Michael. The wheels of the justice system in Ireland can quite often move at a glacial speed, and it would be nearly 3 years before Richard Carney's murder trial began in April 2001. He was now 20 years old. When questioned in the witness box, he spun a tale about how it had been another man, a heroin addict whom he knew, that had carried out the killing. He said that he had only witnessed it and hadn't struck Marie Dillon at all. In his testimony, he stated that this other man had pushed her real hard and she fell to the ground, and that he had started hitting and kicking her. When asked if this man had used any implement to hit Mrs. Dillon with, Carney replied, "With that rake there," pointing to the garden rake we had recovered from the garage and was now an exhibit before the court. Carney went on to allege that this mystery man then went through the woman's pockets and removed some of her lower clothing. When the garden member who had arrested Carney on the morning of Friday, 27 November 1998, took to the box, he gave evidence that following the arrest, he had taken a written statement from him, and there had been no mention of another individual being present at the scene. Instead, Carney had said that he had broken into Marie Dillon's garage to steal the radio from her car. The statement read, "When I did, I saw a woman coming in the gate. She asked what I was doing there, and I said I was hiding as people were going to kill me. She walked into the garage to see what I was doing, and I was afraid she was going to know me. So as she walked by the driver's door, I went after her and pushed her. She fell to the ground. I stood looking at her for a minute. I panicked, and I think I got blood on my runners. She wasn't moving. I had to step over her again to get out past her, and fled. I was thinking, did I kill her, or was she all right? I went to bed, but didn't sleep. I lost a head on that night, and I'm sorry now that it happened." In presenting their case to the jury, the prosecution detailed the damning forensic evidence implicating Richard Carney as the sole attacker. There was Marie's blood on his runners, his blood on her bra, and of course his blood on the rake, and the many fingerprints. After 10 hours of deliberation, the jury found Richard Carney guilty of murder. He received a mandatory life sentence. It would not be, however, the last time that he was before the courts. A life sentence in Ireland means a prisoner typically has to serve between 18 and 22 years before being eligible for parole. In 2023, Kearney, who was now in his early 40s, was granted temporary release. That March, he forced his way into an 86-year-old woman's home, robbing and assaulting her, before going on to attack two elderly priests in their home in Clondalkin in County Dublin. Kearney tried to strangle one of the priests, who was 74 years old. The other priest, who was 86, broke his hip during the attack. Kearney was also accused of falsely imprisoning his former prison chaplain in the bathroom of her house. Just like with the Marie Dillon case, the victims were quite elderly and not in a position to resist or defend themselves. Kearney was sentenced to a further 8 years and remains in prison for now. The killing of Marie Dillon in 1998 was the first murder investigation that I was directly involved in. It wouldn't be the last. It remains memorable for me for a number of reasons. I was part of the team and got to see real forensic experts at work and how each of them was an essential part of what makes a team from the Technical Bureau such an important piece of an investigation in suspicious death cases. I got to witness the inimitable Dr. Mary Cassidy at work, and I was right there when the crucial fingerprint identification was made, which played such a vital role in the eventual solving of the case. It was also a lesson in the value of a bit of luck and a bit of diligent police work. I think back to that jacket and the guard who took Kearney's prints before he could leave the station that day. Without that sequence of events, seemingly pretty innocuous at the time, we may never have been able to discover the truth in this case. As for the why of it, we never did find out what drove him to do it. We can speculate and we can look at his later deeds to maybe understand it more, but we can never know for sure. Often in murder cases, you accept you will only uncover part of the picture. You just hope that the parts you uncover are enough to tell the story and to ensure that the victim can get justice. Thank you for listening to this episode of Lines of Inquiry. If you enjoyed the podcast, please consider giving us a 5-star rating and review, sharing it to your story on social media, leaving a comment below, or simply telling a friend you enjoyed it. Lines of Inquiry is presented by me, John Sweetman. The podcast is created by Darren Cleary. Our executive producer is Owen Brennan. Siobhan Walsh is our producer. Sound editing and design are by Neil Kavanagh. This episode was written by myself, John Sweetman, and edited by Owen Brennan. Join me next time as we open another case and follow the evidence wherever it leads. In the end, everything done in the dark comes to light. In the next episode of Lines of Inquiry, the mysterious vanishing of Barbara Walsh, a mother of seven gone without a trace, the truth of what happened locked away within a tight-knit Gaeltacht community, and the 40-year search for answers.